The Legal Lowdown on Kerry Today.
Yeah, Miriam McGillicuddy, solicitor in Tralee, joins us on the line for The Legal Lowdown. Miriam, good morning to you. Thanks for joining us in the programme.
Good morning, Jerry, and good morning, listeners, on this beautiful, fine morning.
Indeed, and anyone who needs to get your queries into us, get them into us now. WhatsApp 083-300-300. You can text them into us as well on that number, or email the more detailed ones to kerrytoday@radiokerry.ie. Now, a number of queries we need to get to from the last time, Miriam. One listener gets in touch and asks, if a farmer's animals breaks into a next-door neighbour's land and from there they go out into a public roadway and are the cause of an accident, who is then liable?
Yeah, I mean, this is a difficult one and one that can happen, you know, quite frequently in country areas. I suppose the duty is generally on the landowner to prevent the escape of his animals, or his or her animals, and it puts an onus on the occupier to make sure there's shockproof fencing and to make sure that the animals don't escape. The problem is, if you're a motor driver going along the road and an animal escapes from a particular piece of land, if you're and it causes you injury, if you're likely to sue, you would probably address suing both the landowner from which the animal escaped and the original owner of the animal. So to some extent it can get people involved where animals have escaped onto their land and then they escape onto the public roadway. So I suppose for landowners it's really important to be wary, and if they find that there's cattle or other animals trespassing from neighbouring land, that they notify the person, request them to take them back. And there are avenues of redress. For example, if it was horses, and they've come onto your land and then they're in danger of escaping onto the roadway, that you'd notify the council that they're on your land and that they need to be removed. So I suppose as landowners, people can't be unwary, and they need to be wary if cattle or other animals are trespassing onto their land. You see, as well, there's an onus on all landowners generally to ensure that they've shockproof fencing unless they're in an area where it's commonage and there's no tradition of fencing. And having said all that, on landowners, there's a duty to take the reasonable care to ensure that you have the shockproof fencing, and it's not strict liability. Like, just because an animal escapes from a piece of land, it doesn't automatically mean that landowner is liable.
Yeah. And the more you can do to show you have taken care,
exactly,
the better it'll be for you in terms of something does happen.
Exactly. And there was one big case in 1986 where a horse escaped and the landowner was found not liable because they'd taken all due care. So it just shows that, I suppose, as landowners, people need to look out for things like the shockproof fencing. And another area where problems going to arise is gates and keeping gates closed. And I know in a lot of lands they've automatic closing gates, if you know what I mean. So if somebody by chance opens a gate, that it'll close automatically after them, or they've big signs on the gate to make sure that you close the gate after you. So they're very handy as well to make sure that the animals don't escape.
Okay, all right, Miriam. We'll get to our next query. A listener gets in touch and says, my father passed away 10 years ago. I never got to see his will. My mother and he were divorced 40 years ago and he had a family with another woman after that. He never married this woman, yet they got everything. What can I do about this?
Yeah, a difficult situation. And at the end of the day, parents have a duty in relation to making proper provision for all their children. And if they don't, there is a provision in the Succession Act where somebody can sue within 6 months of the grant of probate for a just and proper share. The problem here is that it may be too long ago. And sometimes what happens is the dad might have given the land over or whatever assets he had to the children before his death. And if that was the case, there's very little that his other children can do. But if it was after his death, they may have this Section 117 provision. I suppose what this case highlights as well is the importance, you know, as with more and more second families, blended families, etc., that making succession provision for all the family is important, of all the, you know, successors, and to be equal in relation to all children if people are married a number of times.
And Jerry, that's a key one to remember with that.
Yeah, I suppose it's a very difficult situation, because from the looks of it, it's too late now to bring this action, you know, to get a fair share of the estate. So the person may be too late, but it would be important to get advice, because the Section 117 action that we spoke about is only from the grant of probate. So if no probate was taken out in relation to a will, there may still be a position, they may still have a position in relation to it. So I would say to the person to get legal advice in any event in the matter, even though it's a good bit down the road, just to see if anything can be done at this stage.
Okay. All right, speaking of probate, what roughly does it cost to probate?
Yeah, I think we've spoken about this before, like it's how long is a piece of string, but it depends on the, very often on the value of the estate and how much is involved, in the sense of, is it a house? Are there lots of properties? Is there a lot of bank accounts? Are there lots of shares? But generally, you're talking about a few thousand euro upwards. So people, I suppose, when we talk about probate and things going to probate and having to take out a grant to probate and validate the person's estate, it can be, you know, expensive. I think as well, the cost of probate highlights that there is a way of avoiding that by putting property into joint names prior to one's death. And if one does that, then it can mean that one doesn't actually have to take out a grant to probate. So it's just something to look out for when the person was actually mentioning this. Now, obviously, in a lot of estates, you've no choice but to go to probate and get out the grant. But there are some ways around it with proper planning.
And that is the one thing about trying to get it done that way. And from that point of view, then, look, the cost, like you said, it just depends how much work, how much effort,
exactly,
how hard it is to find things, how long it takes in terms of hours of work,
exactly,
for a legal team.
That's it at the end of the day. And sometimes the states take, a huge amount of work. One area that is quite problematic at the moment would be shares. And one is operating through Irish and English companies, and it's quite complicated. And also state savings. There's quite a lot involved in trying to get state savings over into the beneficiaries' names. Quite,
yeah,
a lot of work. Now, obviously, it's worth it to the beneficiaries at the end of the day. But sometimes people are wondering, why is it taking so long? But all communication is usually by post, and it can take a lot longer because one is dealing with maybe with English companies who are involved with the shareholdings.
That can happen too. Okay, we have more queries to get to, including one on derelict properties. We'll get to that with Miriam on the Legal Lowdown after we take these.
The Legal Lowdown on Kerry Today.
Yeah, we're on air with Miriam McGillicuddy, and we're talking about legal queries, your legal queries. And a listener gets in touch and says, in terms of derelict properties, maybe on some of these properties there are no wills and are just left as an eyesore. Maybe Miriam could give her view on this.
Yeah, and thanks for the contribution there, listener. And it is a big difficulty. And often, as you say, it may be related to title issues. Maybe the title hasn't been sorted out, lost title deeds, not sorting out maybe devolution of title from way back, like to great grandfather's time or even beyond. And that can lead to the difficulty, as also that maybe extracting all, you know, dealing with the property would involve a lot of tax, which people can't afford to pay. And maybe a tax amnesty around that would be helpful. But at the end of the day, there is the Derelict Sites Act, and that is a very good procedure that the County Council apply. And once that procedure gets in train, it does force people to try and sort out the title issues and get them organised so that they can sell the property and benefit the beneficiaries. If they can't find the title and there's a real difficulty with title, at the end of that derelict sites procedure, the council can compulsorily purchase the property. And by virtue of doing that, they clean up title. And effectively, they usually buy the property from the, can buy the property from the beneficiaries at a fair valuation. So, in fact, the derelict sites procedure isn't a good way at the end of the day of sorting out title on a property where the title is totally lost and out of control, as it were. So that is an avenue, but it's good that you highlighted it, because obviously it's something that the local authority are keeping a close eye on.
There has been criticism because of several high profile cases of the lack of speed at which local authorities deal with this and how they take action and the rights of people who own it, maybe even that they're doing nothing with it. I think there should hopefully be a change where there is all these thorny problems that can't be resolved or are failing to be resolved, that the local authority will just be able to take over much quicker than up to now in the middle of a housing crisis.
That's quite true, Gerry. Now, even if it's, as it stands, they follow a set procedure. Often when people are served with the derelict sites notice, it puts them into high speed in trying to sort it out. So it does help. Definitely. But as you say, maybe then if there's really obdurate problems, problems that can't be sorted out, knotty title problems, at the end of the day, going to the end point in the procedure may have to be done quite quickly.
Yeah, okay. Another listener, and speaking of more problems, Miriam, will you ask Miriam what happens in the case where someone died 10 years ago but the executor of the will hasn't dealt with the will? A property was willed to someone, no property tax has been paid on the house since.
Yeah, very difficult situation for that person. I mean, all one can do is approach the executors and approach the executors first, see if they'll do something about it, then maybe follow up with solicitor's letters. But at the end of the day, if they don't do anything about it, one may have to go to court to get it sorted out. And an executors could be replaced by the court as well with the residuary legatee or another beneficiary under the will to ensure that the will is processed correctly. I mean, there may be particular issues behind the scenes here that we don't know about, but certainly it would be important. I think it would be important to go to your solicitor and get it followed up on.
Okay. Does Miriam believe that in cases of domestic violence and mental health issues in a marriage, it's difficult to get out of a marriage with the above issues? Now, we don't know, is it on one side or the other, or how that's working, but in general, I suppose.
Yeah, I suppose at the moment with getting out of marriages, as it were, there's a number of routes, nullity, you know, stating that the marriage doesn't exist on various grounds. The judicial separation, where you go for a separation and just stay separate and apart, that may be for people who don't believe in divorce or something of that nature. And then there's finally divorce. And it's all no fault. It's basically if one party doesn't want to be in the marriage, they can apply for those remedies once a certain period of time has elapsed or once certain circumstances are in place. Under the piece of legislation, Judicial Separation Act, there are certainly fault grounds. For example, domestic abuse or behaviour or mental health issues would be one of the grounds. But it's very rare now for people to go on fault grounds, you know, saying the other party's at fault within a marriage. It's more usual to say, look, I don't want to be here anymore and I'm going for my remedies.
All right. A query in here from a listener as well, Miriam, says a woman has been divorced for a number of years. She has held on to her married name since then and is wondering, would doing this affect her down the road in relation to any family inheritances or other legal matters? And if she should revert back to her old name, I suppose changing back to her old name, would that make any legal change for her?
No. I mean, you can use the beauty of, I suppose, the married name is you can use either your birth name that's on your birth cert, or you can use a combination, like a double barrel name, or you can use your married name and you're still the same person. I mean, if there was any conflict about it, one can simply do up an affidavit to say, I'm this person and this is my married name and my birth name is X and Mrs. Murphy, say, or Alex Murphy, say, for all the world. And my married name is Alex Murphy Scannell, and I'm now going as Mrs. Scannell, say, for example, obviously can I be identified very clearly from your birth cert and your marriage certificate, so there would never be any dispute about inheritances or who you are, or that you're the correct beneficiary. If there's ever a problem about it with state authorities or other authorities or establishing identity, a simple affidavit or declaration will sort that out. Now, I have had difficulties recently. Say somebody has been using their married name all the time for bank accounts and everything else, and then maybe they want to change back to their maiden name or their birth name. It has been difficult to get authorities sometimes to change back to the birth name. But once one is using the birth name for a period of time, they should change it back. And if necessary, to get a solicitor to write in to the authority, the bank or social welfare or whoever, and say, look, I'm moving from my married name back to my maiden name. Yeah, okay. So that people have that choice of using, as I said, either their birth name, a double married name, combination of birth and married name, or the married name.
Okay, all right, another query here, and this is, I suppose, I don't know if it's going into the realms of public liability insurance or what happens in terms of private and public property, but could you please tell me whose responsibility is it to clear the footpaths going into a shopping centre? I walked yesterday with a buggy, and thank God I had to hold onto it, as the path's extremely slippery from layers of wet leaves. Only a matter of time before someone falls and really hurts themselves. I think this needs urgent attention. So is this either, depending on where it is, the shopping centre situation or the local authority situation, or neither?
Yeah, I mean, this is a kind of a difficult one. I suppose the most important thing, first of all, is to make the shopping centre aware of the danger outside.
Yeah.
Reporting it to a manager, sending in an email. Well,
like if it's in the cartilage of their own car park, if it's next to their shop, part of the shopping centre itself, then make them aware of it. They would need to know. It would be their responsibility, shall we say.
Need to know, well, it depends, Jerry, because some shopping centres, the area outside them would be public authority.
Right.
And the roads and services may be in charge of the council. If there's a day with the council liability, if they do something on the roads and footpaths and do it badly, they're liable, like they do a bad repair.
Yeah.
If they just leave it, and it's something naturally occurring like leaves, they may not be liable. However, so it's a question of who actually owns the property or who has charge of it. Now, having said all that, if you're an entrant into a shopping centre, you're a kind of the highest form of entrant, a visitor or whatever, there is, one could say that there is a liability on the shopping centre in relation to their entrances, to make sure they're looked after and to take reasonable care, and to make sure that there's not a danger on it that's a danger to users going into the shopping centre. So one would query whether there could be liability on a shopping centre even though the area around it has been taken in charge by a council. So at the end of the day, it might be a question for a judge to decide. One doesn't want to slip and get injured, basically, hopefully, in that situation, because if the outside areas are in charge of the council, who is liable could break down between the council then and the shopping centre. But in most cases, of course, a shopping centre would have been charged and be the controller of their environment. They don't have the defence of non-feasance that I spoke about earlier on, and they have a duty to maintain and make sure that all the area around their shopping centre is safe for the people coming into it. So at the end of the day, I think it's important that she notifies the shopping centre manager, preferably in writing, just send in an email and say that she found this difficulty. Because it's alerting, hopefully, to make sure that there are no accidents in the area.
Okay. All right, Miriam, listen, we're out of time, but thanks a million for answering all those queries for us. Anyone with any more queries for Miriam, get in touch with us. She'll be back with us next month for the Legal Lowdown. Thanks, Miriam. Great stuff.
Thank you, Miriam, Jerry.